everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about the books we write and the lives we lead and how these two are one in the same. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, as well as their outstanding summer writers conference, please go to pnwa.org. You know, when I interviewed Lydia Yuknovich, whose interview is live on Author right now, and of course will be live into perpetuity in our archives, when I interviewed Lydia Yuknovich, who's a memoirist and novelist, we got onto the subject of the thin membrane separating fiction from memoir. It was my opinion that the difference is that thin, and she agreed with me, but it was her opinion that this is not the prevailing attitude in the world of publishing, where memoir is increasingly popular. And perhaps no one has challenged that question of the line between fiction and memoir in one way than today's guest, Bonnie Ruff, the author of Carrier, Untangling the Danger in My DNA. And so let's get her on the show and find out what is up. Bonnie, welcome to Author.
Thank you so much, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, for our listeners who are not familiar with Carrier, I know you've had to say this many, many times, but maybe give them a brief description of the unique nature of what the story is of that book, your first memoir.
Sure, I'd love to. Carrier is the story of a genetic disorder which runs in my family and the decision-making process that my husband and I faced when we were thinking about starting a family of our own. We found out that I do carry a genetic disorder which very much shaped, and not necessarily in positive ways, my grandfather's life and experience. And we had to ask ourselves, now that we're in this modern era of medical genetics and we can have information that my parents and grandparents couldn't have imagined, we actually had choices. We could find out for sure whether, as I said, I might put our potential future children at risk, and then we could find out whether, if we had conceived a pregnancy, whether our baby might be affected by the disorder. So we had to decide how seriously to take that risk. So I can, in a minute, I'll tell you a little bit about the disorder, but it's really just, it's a story of us deciding whether and then how to have children, and how my grandfather's story and my mother's experience as both the daughter and the mother of men with the disorder shaped our choices.
Yeah, how it impacted. Boy, there are so many, I'm not a big fan of the word issues, but that's just, I can't think of a better one. So many issues that this particular story raises. And because Everything in my life seems to pass through the filter of writers, it even, for me, brings up issues central to writers. But before we get to that, I had mentioned in the intro that this sort of what Lydia and I talked about, the membrane between fiction and memoir, and the sort of and the question of truth in memoir and in memory. Your name first came up when Jana Corse-Essery and I were talking about memoir and this issue of truth and how much is true and how much isn't true. And you took a very unusual step in writing Carrier, in that you had, when you wrote about your mother and your grandfather, your maternal grandfather, you mm-hmm. wrote in their voices.
That's right. Yeah. Carrier.
All right. So tell us, to discuss that for us. I can imagine how that would come to be, just as a writer, how I would choose to do that. One would choose to do that. But mm-hmm. how did you come to that decision?
Well, it's interesting that you would ask it using that word decision, because I don't remember there ever being a point when I made a choice to tell the story in more voices than my own. When I sat down to write,
that's the best way to make the decision, quote unquote.
Yeah, right. It made itself for me, because when I sat down to write, you know, I had spent years researching my grandfather's life story, traveling the West and combing through archives and photos and letters and notes and doing interviews. And finally, when it was time to start writing down his story, it had really already been told to me. I had his voice telling me his story in my mind. I actually didn't know what was going to come out on the page, and I was as surprised as some of my readers have been to discover that this book and project that I was calling a memoir and calling, you know, a true story,
right,
started coming out as a rather probably a fictive sounding voice of a boy growing up in Nebraska in the 1930s.
Right. And obviously this calls into, you know, when I interviewed Alexandra Fuller, who's written a couple of wonderful memoirs, particularly about growing up in South Africa and her relationship to her very charismatic and larger-than-life mother, she really saw memoir as the truth. Let's get the truth, get the truth. She'd come from a journalistic background, even though she herself wrote with a very almost novelistic voice, I felt, really, which really I felt worked very well for her piece. But the issue of the truth, you know, one of my, and I'd be curious to hear what you think about this, one of my examples of the difficulty with the truth is if I have an argument with my wife about something, and we begin the argument at 7 o'clock, and hopefully it's over by 7:30, and then we're trying to remember how it started, and neither of us can agree. And that was 30 minutes before. And so now here we are trying to reconstruct maybe 30 years or just 3 years before. How does one, what does one decide the truth is at that point, the truth?
Well, to me, for it, when I was writing Carrier, everything was driven by my intention in telling the story, which was to share with readers what it looks like for or looked like for one couple to thoughtfully approach an unprecedented ethical dilemma.
Right.
And part of that exploration and that choice-making process was looking at the stories of our ancestors, mine in particular, to see what we could learn from them. And so when I'm telling the story about deciding finally not to do IVF and pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, to go ahead with a natural conception, I'm telling it right alongside the story, you know, my grandfather sharing with me his story, my mother sharing with me her story, in as a way of showing the reader, these are the narratives that I have playing in my mind.
Right.
While I make these choices. And to me, I mean, the wonderful thing is that I know my readers are brilliant, and so they can see that, you know, that what I'm doing is sharing with them the stories that mattered to me. And that, in a way, I think obviated the truth or untruth question, because if these stories were true enough and significant enough for me to use them as a touchstone in making some of the most impactful decisions of my adult life,
right,
it's got to be true enough for a reader.
Well, and what I love about how you just described that is this. I read in an interview you described the moment where the story really took shape, where your one of your advisors at the Iowa School of Iowa Writers School, the University of Iowa, and you were doing a thesis, which was this story, and the advisor made the observation finally, because I guess they didn't feel the story was coming together, that it was about how their lives and that story of your mother and your grandfather impacted you. That was when it began to come, if I understood your description correctly, that was aha moment. Oh, well, of course this is just a good story. This directly affects me because I'm a carrier possibly of this, which you are, it turns out.
Right, exactly. I kept getting asked that question that all of us as memoirists kind of have to remember to get back to and eventually center on, which is, why are you writing this story, and why are you writing this story now?
Right.
And I hadn't answered that in my depiction of my grandfather and my mother, but I had started to approach it in some of my other work, and one of my thesis advisors knew that. And so he said, well, you know, isn't it true that your grandfather's story represents your own worst fears for your future children? And right then the hair on the back of my neck stood up. It's like, he's right. That's perfect. That's, how did I not see that that I am, after all, going to be at the center of this story.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. And what I love about you using the voice of your grandfather and the voice of your mother is that the fact is, the truth of someone's life, the truth of a human being's life, is the narratives playing in their mind that impact the choice, whether those narratives are true or false. You know, like Hitler had a narrative playing in his mind about the Jews. It wasn't true, but it was playing in his mind, and it drove his actions. And I'm sorry to compare you to Hitler, but you know, all of us have these narratives playing in our minds. And the story of your mother living with your grandfather's suffering, if he was suffering, and your grandfather's life, whatever that was, which wasn't an easy one, had to play in your, whether it's actually relevant or not, it's there nonetheless.
Right.
And aren't we always in constant dialogue with the stories that we've been telling our whole lives that are running through us?
Which is why I think that there's, in all this debate about truth and nonfiction, there's sort of a missing piece, which is the interpretive ability of the reader. Now, certainly there are people who really want to take advantage of the typical expectations when you're told you're reading a true story. But there are a lot more, I think, literary writers of memoir who are creating works that ask the reader to suspend disbelief in one way or another. And I believe that the readers are more than capable of doing that. And in fact, you know, there's, I'm so glad that I was able to trust that my readers would know that, of course, these voices are being filtered through my experience, so that I didn't have to waste a lot of space on the page going, and then I imagine that my mother would have thought this, and
right.
perhaps my grandfather did this, or perhaps that. I mean, the perhaps is implicit in the conceit of this, the way the story is put together. So.
Yeah. Well, it's just great. And, you know, I'm going to put this one out to you, too, about truth and memory. And I'll do this, in fact, not to bring up my wife again, but when we have discussions...
You can bring up your wife, just don't bring up Hitler again.
No, I'm sorry. No, I won't bring Hitler's Dutch. No, but when I talk to him, if we're having some discussion, we're having some disagreement or whatever, one of the things is, like, I'll say, look, I don't actually know what happened, but I do know I felt like this. I know I felt angry or happy or sad. I always know what I felt like. Now, what the reality of what might have happened around that is murky, but I always remember how it felt. And to some degree, I think, as I'm writing my own memoir now, what I go back for first, I do remember the events, quote unquote, but what I really remember is the felt reality of that event.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I feel like that's what I am reaching for in my own work. Is that true for you or not?
Yes, and I think that is the perfect starting place and sort of a good indicator that there's something worth exploring there. My friend Kate Hopper this year came out with a new writing guide called Use Your Words, and one of the things that she reminds readers and writers in that book is that when you sit down to really work with that feeling, that remembered feeling, and begin to explore it, the events actually become more clear. The details emerge. You remember more than you think you do. So it seems like those emotional memories are the ones that are kind of signposts for us to pay attention to.
Yeah.
That's where there's some excavation to be done, and that's where we're going to make a discovery when we write.
It's so true. In fact, I know what I do. I mean, this is how I've told stories my whole life, and about my own life, say. But in my, whether my long-form memoir or my short, usually it begins with essentially a single moment that feels poignant. And for some reason, I don't know why, but I can feel that moment where something turned in my life, or something opened up, or it stuck out. And then often my job is to go back and both understand why it was meaningful to me. Sometimes I think I know on the surface, but the meaning is much deeper. So to both understand it, and then, of course, being the job of the storyteller, reveal its poignancy so that the audience, the reader, understands more or less the same thing I do. But it begins with something often bright, but not yet understood by me.
Exactly.
Is that how it
yeah.
feels for you?
And, Oh, yeah, completely. And I know a lot of writers feel that way, that, you know, there's we're looking for things when we sit down to write. And it's important to pay attention to those poignant or pivotal moments that keep speaking to us. And I think what I have a tendency to do is miss the signal a little bit, because I'm one of those people whose frequent writing error is to think I have to have it all figured out before I get to the page. And I think I'm getting past that now as I'm working on my next book. I feel like somehow, you know, you can hear that advice 100 times, but somehow it's finally sinking in, and I'm realizing that I just have to go there. And of course, it seems to be fruitful. A lot seems to be coming out for me. So,
that's
just sort
true.
Of a matter of trusting that's something you can only figure out on the page.
It's absolutely true, and the issue of trust is one that comes up all the time for writers, whether they're people like my friend and the novelist Deb Colletti, who knows she can't outline a page, she just can't, and so she really has to just completely trust that she's going to go and figure it out, or people who do write, a lot of writers who have sort of a vague outline, but even they know it could change, and that willingness to say, I have an idea, but I'm going to really learn when I get in there. I can't know it all. I can't see it all. Maybe sometimes a story comes to you fully formed, like from the mind of Zeus or whatever. But I think for most of us, we have to surrender to the notion that it is a discovery and we can't know it. We can't until we go in.
Right. Yeah, there are some really nice, I think some of the writing advice that's been especially poignant for me as I prepared to get started on a new project have been the people who remind us that it's necessary to take the grand vision and essentially decimate it and start from, you know, you reduce it dramatically when you go from that glimmering image in your imagination to actually starting to put words on the page. With every word you add, the possibilities for what the work can be diminish further and further, but
yes,
also with that specificity, that is how the work and the art is actually created.
That's right. That's right. It starts in your mind, and it's also beautiful, but we have no idea just how vague it is. And as soon as you go to the page, you see the holes, and you see you have to make a choice. And even your life, you know, to some degree, our lives are that we lead are so much about making peace with it. Every choice we make, there's another dozen choices we didn't. And to some degree, and those doors to some degree close. And there has
they
to
do.
Be peace with that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a football player. I never did do that, you know. But I could have, maybe, you know, once upon a time. But I never, you know, but I made other choices, and so I didn't live that life.
There's something about that rings really true for what's behind a midlife crisis, too, I think.
Oh,
not
absolutely.
That I'm speaking from experience or anything, but.
Well, I can speak from experience, and indeed, you know, I always knew I wanted to write, so there wasn't that looking back like, oh, I got to do something. But, it, you know, I have known plenty of people who have looked up and had all this money and have figured out how to survive, essentially. I can pay the bills, I can take a vacation, I can have this. Now what the hell do I do? You know, now what? Why did I learn how to do this game called being an adult, you know, and having a family? It just weren't enough, you know. And that's the nice thing about about the challenge of book writing, it seems to me, and I know you're learning this with your next book, is that the challenge never ends. The mountain is always presented to you again and again and again, and it's different each time.
Right.
And you're doing that now with your next book. I assume that, you've now, Carrier was your first, and now you have set up camp and begun another journey.
Yeah, so actually, literally, I'm at camp right now. I've subleased a corner of my amazing artist friend's sculpture studio. So I'm down in the rainy flats of Ballard in Seattle, at my little table where I've been coming lately to add pages to this next work. Carrier ultimately went over, you know, my deciding to have healthy children who wouldn't suffer from a difference that I could have prevented, particularly something that would have affected appearance and ability to regulate body heat. And so ultimately, what's happened as I've gone, you know, on my book tour and done readings and met audiences and book clubs, I've noticed that one question comes up more frequently than, well, two. I mean, I think there's that common memoir question, what does your family think of this?
Right,
but beyond that, there's a sort of an extension of that question that I keep getting, and this is because my book deals with difficult issues, looking at the possibility of abortion as an imperfect way to get to what is probably not a bad goal, which is a child, you know, one's future children's health, and considering that as an option in my story. And so, you know, that obviously is taboo in many ways for many people in American culture. And so when I've met audiences, this question that keeps coming up is, what about your daughters? I have two daughters now. What about your daughters, they say. So I interpret for them, do you mean what happens when my daughters read this book?
Right.
Yeah. What happens when my daughters find out that I had an abortion? Yeah, that's what they mean.
Right.
And I've never felt like I have a satisfactory answer. That's what this book is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what this book is. I've never felt like I had a good answer for that. I felt like I'm quite boring when I answer that question. I kind of shrug and say, well, for one thing, I'll be lucky if my kids ever want to read anything I write. I don't assume they will. And if they do, I would hope that my parenting up to that point would have let them know that this is part of the story of their family and there wouldn't be anything in the book that would be a surprise.
Right.
And the more I thought about that, the more I realized, what's behind this question? What's behind this question is this sort of persistent need to keep from our daughters the stories of real female experience in our society. And so now what I'm working on is a very straightforward story of my sexuality, my female experience, with the intention of being honest with my daughters and hopefully with many other young women. And so it's very straightforward.
And when you say your sexuality, you're talking about your whole sexuality, just the awakening to it, that's a part of your adult life and the whole thing.
Absolutely. From just beginning with those pivotal moments when I began to understand I'm a girl, I'm not a boy, what's the difference? All the way up to now where, you know, sexuality is something that obviously continues to grow and change, hopefully, along with, you know, every other part of a whole person. But and I'm hopefully nowhere near the end of that journey. But up to now, I feel like in many ways there was way too much learning about my body and my role as a female, whether that role was accepted or not, that had to wait, that I didn't really figure out until what I would consider to be too late or borderline too late, and things that I would hope my daughters would know and understand about the way we treat women, about the way, you know, even specific things, you know, what's this whole childbirth thing, what's breastfeeding, ooh, that's weird. You know, I've learned so much, and I think right now both of my children are so intact in their sense of the female body and the female experience as wholly valuable. And I know how under threat that can come in the cultural kind of tidal wave that they're about to encounter. My oldest daughter's learning to read. You know, what happens in a few days when she realizes that the tag in the back of her favorite monster pajamas says boys? That, you know, let it begin. But I guess I want to do an answer to that question, what about your daughters? I want to say, what about them? How about a full answer? Not how am I going to keep this from them? How am I going to make sure they know everything I can possibly help them know? It seems like more the direction we need to go.
You know, it's interesting. My father used to say, the best mathematicians make the worst math teachers. And what he meant by that is that if you were a brilliant mathematician, it was very hard to understand why people couldn't get it. It made no sense to you because it came so intuitively. And I know that for myself in my life, the things that have come the hardest for me, certain issues around certain public issues of mine, these are the ones I'm the best teacher of because I've learned them the most consciously. I've always thought that I'm a poor teacher of the craft of writing because there was a certain element of the craft that came very easily to me, and so I didn't understand it. It just happened, you know, and I couldn't teach it. But and the reason I bring that up is you mentioned that what you've learned about your body and your sexuality, your femininity, you feel you learned late in life. But
yes.
To some degree, you are going to be more conscious of the transition from ignorance to knowledge and will probably make you a better teacher. Because
really
you'll understand the bridge necessary.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Well, I hope it's true. So off I go. I'm about 75 pages in, and every day I have to come in here to the studio, and I'm surrounded by all these amazing artworks that the other artists are doing, and I hunker down with my computer and pretend that nothing else is going on in my life and go back to these pivotal moments that I remember but I've never really explored, like we were talking about earlier, and boy, am I learning a lot. And I'm not rereading it because I think I'd get scared and stop.
No, don't reread it. In fact, what we're going to do, we've got a guest here on hold, and I'm pretty sure I know who it is, and I think he wants to ask us a question. Let's see what he has to say. This must be Jeffries. Is this you?
Is Bill. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Do you have a question for Bonnie?
Well, this is more of just a statement, Bonnie. I wanted to say to you that, you know, it's a wonderful memoir, and these books are written from a woman's perspective. I think this is a book that's relatable to me as a man on just as many levels. And I want to just praise you for your courage.
Thank you.
You're very, very welcome. The book is not, I mean, some of these books can be written sort of, not inflammatorily, but they can be written to sort of say, oh, this is different because it's just so outrageous. I mean, it's clinical, but there's so much heart behind it. And again, I just want to say, I know there must have been many days when you're writing saying, wow, how's this going to be? How are people going to relate to this? Or will they? Are they going to be shocked? I mean, what's going to be the reaction? So we all, as writers, myself, think we want to be fearless and we'll be able to give our best work and be courageous, but you did. And I wanted to commend you for that. It's a wonderful book, and I hope everyone picks this book up. Well done.
Thank you
so much. My goodness, much appreciated.
You know, I love the word that he used, courage, because courage comes from, I think, from the Latin word cor, which means heart. And I've always felt that, you know, you in a really good memoir, you must allow as much vulnerability as possible, I think, for it to be successful. And it's not always easy. But there's a great quote from a book called A Course in Miracles that says, "In my defenselessness, my safety lies." And I think I just think it's one of the great discoveries that I learn again and again and again in my own work, that if I can allow myself no defenses, I discover true safety in my own life, and I hope I can share it with my readers.
To me, what that means in terms of craft is telling one's story without trying to also defend it at the same time, which I'm the first person who needs to be reminded not to do that, because of course I want to get up there and stand on my soapbox and say, this is how it needs to be and this is how we're going to get there. But ultimately with Carrier and as my next book, my challenge, and I think that so far so good with Carrier, it's in some ways it's hard to criticize in that I'm not telling anyone else what they should do, and I'm simply putting forward my story, and I hope that's what I can accomplish with my next book as well.
Well, Bonnie, best of luck with that. I'm sure you'll do a great job. Best of luck.
Thank you so much, Bill, and best wishes to you and your memoir.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for coming on the show. And everyone, I hope you enjoyed that. God, I sure know I did. We'll be looking forward to that next book. We don't know what it's called. I bet she doesn't either. But it sounds like it's going to be a good one. Next week, I am talking to Andrea Pollard. We'll be talking about happiness and spirituality in East and West when they meet. Until then, do what you love, write what you love, and you can't go wrong. This is a true story.